Fantastic Receipts for seminar. I'm sure you're all very excited to hear Peter and the seminar for the Public Square, and so you should be. Now, I am no stranger to Peter and the Director of the Evangelical Alliance or the work of EA. I actually worked for Peter last year as an intern at the Evangelical Alliance. So I know how fantastic the work is, and it's great to see my old boss, and not many people can say that. So I'm sure you will enjoy this. I'm sure many of you have seen Peter's name in articles or maybe in newspapers, maybe you've heard him on the radio. And he does a fantastic job at seeming to be the voice of Christ in the public sphere, the political sphere, and to the media. And so just before Peter comes to speak with us this afternoon, I'm just going to pray for him. Dear Father, thank you for the work that Peter does and the work of Evangelical Alliance. Thank you that they bring your voice, Lord, of hope, of compassion and peace to our local context in Northern Ireland. I pray your blessing upon the organisation and that you'll protect them and that you'll continue, Lord, to use them and to bring your voice of influence in this country. I pray that you'll put your blessing on him now as he comes to speak with us about those really important matters. In your precious name, amen.
Amen. Thank you. Thank you. It's great to be here. It's wonderful to be in this dance space. We're going to end in a bit of liturgical dance, just to get you all psyched up for that, so you can start stretching and warming up. So we're looking at faith in the public square, changing culture. How do we do that? So as Hannah said, my name's Peter Linus. I used to work as a lawyer. I have repented of that, having worked for five years, dressing up as a barrister each day and wearing the wig and the gown. I trained in Regent College in Vancouver in theology, a place where J.I. Packer and Eugene Peterson of the Message fame and people like that are. It's great to be able to do that and then now work with the Evangelical Alliance. So very much faith in the public square. What does that look like? Arguing with Nolan and Crawley and folks like that from time to time. And so I want to just think a little bit about that today. And the lens I want to use initially is Daniel. Daniel is one of my heroes. And the book of Daniel, and just thinking a little bit about how we as, particularly as young people, put myself in that camp temporarily, so how do we engage well? The first thing I want to think about is this notion that fluency leads to influence. This may or may not appear. Look at that, awesome. We were having some technical problems there. So I was not much of a linguist when I was at school, and that's a real problem when you travel to certain countries. Because to engage in certain cultures, you just got to be able to speak the language. And if you're fluent in a language, you can really engage with people. So I love traveling to countries like India, where people really wanted to speak English to improve their English. And it was great I could speak to them, because I was rubbish at languages. Went to Brazil, I was a disaster and couldn't communicate with anybody, because I kept trying to speak what limited Spanish I had to people who spoke Portuguese. So it didn't go very well. But so when you can speak the language of a culture, you can engage much more readily in it. When you're fluent within it, you have a certain level of influence. And we see that in the story of Daniel. Daniel chapter 1, I'm not going to read it all, but I am going to just tell you the story, a little bit of it. You're familiar with it. It's so King Jehoiakim's in charge in Israel, well, Judah as it is then, and Nebuchadnezzar comes and he attacks and he besieges the city, and ultimately Jerusalem falls, and he takes everything out of the temple, and then he takes some of the people with him, and he gets some of the finest members of the nobility, young men without defect, who are handsome and well-versed in wisdom. And so he gets this group of people and he takes them off, Nebuchadnezzar, with him back to Babylon, to modern-day Iraq. And they are to serve in the king's palace. And they are trained then in Babylonian literature and Babylonian culture. They are given the finest food from the king's table, the lovely, rich, juicy red meat, and this lovely wine that comes from the king's table. And they are educated for 3 years. And among them is Daniel and his three mates, shake the bed, make the bed, and into bed you go. And so these guys are amongst the folks who are renamed. And of course we know well that Daniel then says, no, I'm not going to defile myself in this way. And so he goes and he does this test for 10 days and says, please let me have water and vegetables. Are you crazy? Just have that. So he says, I don't want to eat the king's food. And so the guy in charge is nervous about that. And he says, let's do this 10-day test. and they do that, and the guys look good in after 10 days, and so he agrees to let them keep going at that. And so for 3 years, they do the water and veg thing. And at the end of the time, the king brings everybody in, before they're brought in before Nebuchadnezzar, and he chats to them all, and he found no one compared with Daniel and his mates in matters of wisdom. Nobody else. They were 10 times better than anybody else in his kingdom. And then the last verse of chapter 1 says this, and Daniel continued there until the first year of King Cyrus. And we don't know our history very well, and we don't realize, oh, that's 70 years. Like, he's a real dominant influence for 70 years. The whole time that they're in exile, Daniel is a key leader, a key public official. So when they're taken captive, the first thing that happens, which wasn't unusual, was that they're trained in the Babylonian culture. They do like a 3-year apprenticeship, a degree program, a master's, whatever the way you want to think of it, and they get all this training. And so many of you have done that, or thinking of doing that, or in the midst of doing that. So for me, that was law, and so I studied hard-ish, just hard enough to get into uni. Not the one I wanted, of course. So you study it, you do your 4 years of law, and then I went and did my sort of post-grad stuff in that. Then it kind of occurred to me through conversations with some people, why was it that I was studying so hard to do law, this thing that was apparently secondary in my life? And my faith had got stuck at about the level of a 12-year-old. I was just doing the same stories round and round again. I wasn't taking it seriously. In fact, when I went off to university, I had a real struggle because my faith wasn't ready for the kind of stuff that I was learning at university. And so it was just like parallel world going on. And because I just got stuck in this cycle of Sunday school stories, I felt like I wasn't able to cope with that. Why is it we spend so much time pursuing teaching and engineering or law or business or whatever it is, and so little time invested in our faith? Why do we not take it to the same level? And so Daniel and his friends, they studied the culture of Babylon, they studied the language of it, so that they were able to be influential people. And he rose up to become the senior figure within it. Who am I? Identity. So the story of who we are shapes who we are, and that was really critical to Daniel. He understood his shaping story. And so in Daniel 1 verse 8, we have this great verse that says, Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the king's food and the king's wine. And Daniel knew that if he was to have influence through redemptive participation, he needed to know the story that ultimately shaped him. And so he'd taken on the language and the culture, he'd taken on a new name, but he said, I'm not going to eat the food that comes from the king's table that has been offered to idols beforehand. I'm not going to pledge my allegiance to a false god. I'm not going to lose my identity. I might be in exile. I might be a stranger in a strange land. I might have been carried off and find myself in a very difficult culture. And I will understand it and I will take on a name amongst it, but I'm not going to take food that's been offered to the idols. And so Daniel is trained in one story, but he carries a different one in his heart. And that's probably true for many of us. We're trained in various stories. We go off to university, we're working in context where there's a story, there's a narrative around that, but there's an alternative story deep within our hearts. I love asking this question. If any of you have heard me speak, you've probably heard me ask it before. What's your last God story? So imagine those people who think you're slightly nuts for being a Christian finally say, well, look, okay, so you're a Christian, so tell me the last time God showed up. You come back 10 years ago to some moment where you encountered him? Is it last week? Is it a moment of prophetic insight? Is it a moment of healing? Is it a moment of prayer? Is it a moment where he shows up? Is it a moment of comfort, transformation? Like, when did God last show up? And if we don't have that story, the first thing we need to do is say, God, I want those stories. I want to chase after you. I know you're real and I know you're here. So I want to have some God stories to share with people. Identity, who are we? What's the story that shapes us? Do we know this story? And do we have God's stories to share? Because we can live in a culture with all sorts of other stories, and there's an identity crisis out there. But if we know the story that shapes us, then we can hold a constant in that mix. So identity, then purpose. Why do we do what we do? God isn't just interested in the outcomes, he's interested in what drives us and what motivates us. Daniel resolved not to defile himself. So he had that education put on him and a name, but he resolved. He made a decision. not to take the king's food. And the context is really important here. So the people are in exile. The Israelites have been carried off from Israel. That's where they get their name, yeah? Into Babylon. So they've been taken off into a strange land. And if you are an Israelite, how do you know that God is there? What are the big markers around God? It's the land. Land's really critical. It's the king. You ask God for a king, God gave you a king. He is, in a sense, God's representative, and it's the temple. When you're in exile, what do you not have? No land, no king, no temple. Like, God's gone. Strangers in a strange land. And so again, one of the questions in this seminar was, well, as the culture changes around us, how do we do that? Daniel's a great model. The culture's shifting all over the place around us. And we've come out of a culture, we would say it's a Christian country, and we had a lot of those kind of markers. And as those things begin to shift, we need to learn from folks like Daniel what it's like to be a stranger in a strange land. Where you don't have a king, and you can't just say, here's the land and God has given it to us, and the temple isn't just around the corner, and you can't just nip out at lunchtime and head to the temple and do a quick act of worship. So how do you worship God now if you can't just nip across the road? So in exile, the Israelites discovered God wasn't simply found in a king or represented by a king. He wasn't limited to any one land, and he wasn't simply found in the temple. It was for everyone, everywhere, in every way, every day. And it took them back to this great Hebrew word, avodah, which is a word for work. And they just worked the ground. That's what they were told to do. For 6 days you shall work avodah, but also you shall avodah the Lord your God. You shall worship him with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And so they were to fuse those ideas. And if you can't go to temple, then temple becomes the world around you. That's what it's like for us in our culture. So if we can't go to temple in the same way, then the bank or the classroom or the ward of the hospital becomes temple for us. It's a great story of a bus driver, and became a Christian in the States. And Gordon MacDonald tells this story, and he said, what does that mean for me now that I'm a Christian bus driver? And he drove the morning route in and took a lot of commuters into central New York. And he said, well, what it was as everybody got on his bus, he said, hey, welcome. And as everybody got off, he said, just bless you and have a great day. And as he drove, instead of the normal stop-start franticness, he tried to make it as smooth a journey as possible. And so for that half-hour commute, it began to make a difference for people, because they began to say, hey, I noticed something. This has become a little sanctuary for me on my way into work. It's become just a calm place for me. And in that small way, he made his bus temple. If you can't go to temple, how do you make the area around you? If you can't offer a sacrifice in the temple, then what does it look like to become a living sacrifice? Daniel's way ahead of Paul in Romans 12, offer our bodies as a living sacrifice. He's working out what that means in exile. If you can't perform the holy rituals in the temple, then what does it mean that as you serve each cup of coffee, it becomes a holy ritual? What does it mean that as you sign off each deal or each email and say, be blessed, or as you pray over it in the acts that you do, it becomes a holy ritual? Civil servant said to me, I can't. Worship God openly in where I am. I said, that's rubbish. But anyway, so one of their friends said, well, actually, my computer logs off, after a minute, and I have to put my password in. So I said, well, obviously, nobody knows my password, so I can make it what I like, so it's one of my favorite Psalms. And that's how I do that 20 times a day. That's just how I reorientate. This becomes an act of worship for me. Small things, we're just saying, how do you create the space? How do you log into your phone? What do you do? Little small ways which you reorientate yourself to say, this is important. This is my act of worship. Everything I do is an act of worship to God. Every tweet, every Facebook post, everything I do in work is and can be an act of worship. Reorientate how we're doing things, because everything can be a holy act, a holy ritual. You ask my brother who owns a coffee shop, he thinks pouring coffee is a holy act and a holy ritual. But it is to him in a sense. He is serving people and he loves that. And it's his passion, it's his gifting, and he's gifted in hospitality and in worship, and he loves the notion of serving most days, except his big brother. But we can do that, and everything can become a holy ritual in that purpose. Why do we do what we do? Because when we act with redemptive intent, anything can become an act of worship. But that's the key, when we act with redemptive intent, when we have the intention to transform, to be redemptive. Okay, we'll go controversial. So the Ashurst case, and I'm very involved in and supporter of that. People said to me, but surely they could have served the guy the cake. And I think they could if you were in a relationship. If I knew Gareth Lee well, I'd say, Gareth, I'm going to make you this cake. You know that I don't agree with what you're doing, but I can do it because we're friends. But there was none of that in that moment. I think Asher's acted correctly. But I do think in a different situation, you could have reorientated that. It could have been a transformative moment. Do you understand? So there's a difference because this was a very anonymous transaction. They'd served him previously, etc., etc. Lots of things about that case, not to get sidetracked. But if I knew that person well, if it had been John, somebody I know well within the LGBT community, and John came to me and said, will you come to my wedding? Will you be engaged? I said, yeah, well, probably, because friendship trumps here. And you know where I stand. And you've invited me to events, and I've invited you to events. And in that moment, we can have a transformative relationship. Jesus and the woman of the well was transformative because he spoke in and something happened and it shifted. And he said, no, you've had five husbands. And lo and behold, she goes back and she tells everybody and everybody from the town comes. But if you just met her and served the water and nothing had happened, then that's not transformative. So Jesus isn't interested in the outcome. There are lots of different ways you could have dealt with that scenario, that case, as long as it was about redemptive intent. That was a huge tangent, didn't expect to go on. Interesting. Okay, so purpose, why we do what we do. We're shaped by a story that drives why we do what we do so that anything we do can become an act of worship in the public square, which is everything. How do we do what we do? The power and authority to do what we do. So I travel to Canada sometimes in England, so I have to say power. But what I mean is power, right? The power by which we do that. Anybody know Alan Emerson? No, just prayer and power. Okay, that's just for three people, that joke. I made that joke down the country in Moira, and it turned out there were three Emersons in the room. Oh, there's so many of them, and they were all like, don't you snag our cousin. Anyway, so we tangent again. The power and authority by which we do stuff. Daniel 2:20, so in the next chapter in Daniel, it says, blessed be the name of God, wisdom and power are his, are God's. But then Daniel says, I give thanks and praise to you for you have given me wisdom and power. And Daniel excelled and he was given power. And because he excelled, because he was good at what he did, he had influence and he had power. I was working with Ross Wilson, the artist, on something recently, and he was saying, I don't mind if people don't get my projects or don't like them, but I want them to think that they're done excellently, they're done well. That's what's important to me. What I don't want anybody to say is, oh, that's just rubbish art. No, I might not get it, but it's good, and he has excelled in what he does. And we want to have excellence. So often Christians just say, oh, we'll do it good enough. We'll set this thing, it'll be all right. It's fine, it'll do. And Daniel excelled, and his friends were found to be 10 times wiser than anybody else. 10 times wiser. And that did not come easy, as I hinted earlier. It came through 3 years of drinking water and eating vegetables. My wife is on a plant power revolution in our household, and I blame Rick Warren and his Daniel plan. He's managed to take this one verse and chapter and turn it into a huge book. So my choices are to join that revolution or to go off and buy my own meat and cook it myself. So we haven't totally got rid of it, but there's a sacrifice. Like, it's water and vegetables. They were being offered the finest food. We're talking the best food from the king's table, the finest wine. Daniel says, no, I'm going to have water and I'm going to have vegetables. Does it in community. Doesn't try it himself. He's got a group of mates with him. Important thing, just on the aside. If you're going to try these crazy maverick things for God, good to have some people around you. And God gave Daniel and his friends knowledge and skill in literature and in wisdom, passage tells us. So they became really good at understanding Babylonian literature and Babylonian wisdom. But also Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. There's this incredible integration in his life of the cultural and the supernatural. If we do that, that is incredibly powerful. People who can see and respond culturally and supernaturally stand out. The more godless our culture becomes, the more the need for the Spirit. The more the supernatural stands out. You're not going to reason somebody into the kingdom. I'm pretty good at arguing, ask my wife, and I used to get paid to do it. I've never argued anybody in, because the C.S. Lewis says if somebody can argue in, somebody can argue back out. That is virtually never the thing that makes a difference to somebody. They have an encounter, they have a moment, they meet Jesus. And then we backfill some of the story, we see how it makes sense, we read around it. But there's a moment of encounter. And real power and real authority come when we combine knowledge, intellectual, cultural understanding with the supernatural. And as our culture narrows and narrows and narrows down, that supernatural becomes more and more of a draw to people. I'm going to come back to that point in a moment. So how do we do what we do? We do it with power and authority. That is the distinctive. We have a story that shapes us. It drives our purpose. But it's not about us engaging in wider culture. It is a moment of power and authority. Like the power is supernatural power. And people are looking for it everywhere. And the one place they don't tend to find it is in the church. And so they go to the occult. And they go to Game of Thrones. And they go to the vampire movies. And this apparently highly rational, empirical, scientific age that we all apparently live in looks for all sorts of fantasy movies and fantasy literature and fantasy novels and stuff. That's where we go. Those shouldn't be in the market in our apparently highly scientific and rational age. But of course we go there because we think there's something more. There is something that transcends, that cuts across. So, anybody's ever heard me talk will now be bored for a moment. I'm going back to my favourite thing, the grid, just for a moment, because I think it really helps us understand and frame and our engagement with the public square. What time do we finish? Awesome. It's because we're going so fast. Let's slow down. Okay. For everybody's sake, including mine. Okay, the grid. So, I'm a really artistic person, so this is how I begin the framing of the grid. Well, as I hinted earlier, when I went off to university, I bumped into this other story. And it was the story of what the dominant narrative, I'll call it, I'll explain it a little more in a moment, but it's kind of what all university education is framed on, a particular story and view of the world and way of seeing things. And it seemed to me that my faith was not compatible with what I was learning at university. And so for a while I tried this kind of schizophrenic thing, where I kept my faith over here and what I was learning in university separate, and that doesn't work for very long because God has made us holistic people. And so we resolve those things in one way or another. We're either going to give up on our faith, was my choice, or find some way of working these things together. And so I wasn't sure if my faith went the opposite direction, did it run in parallel, but it seemed to me that never the twain shall meet. And I was really kind of struggling with putting it all together. With the help of some friends, most of whom are sort of dead, like people like C.S. Lewis, but like real live friends as well, people like Barry Ford, the chaplain at Church of Ireland, he and I did our law together. We were beginning to wrestle through some of these things, and I began to see that the story I was being told at university raised more questions than it answered. It wasn't clear where it came from. Who are we? Where are we coming from? Are we just a random collection of cells? Have we evolved from? Are we any different than the animals? Do we have a purpose? Are we made for a relationship? It wasn't really very clear in that story. And it seemed to be going to another set of question marks or isms. There are literally hundreds of those isms. Some of them are things like humanism, the idea that we as human beings could somehow solve our own problems, which is just a posh version of what anybody says at a beauty pageant. I just want to see world peace if we just try a little harder. I'm not going to get into a beauty pageant, obviously. But that's the notion that somehow that we as human beings are the sole solution to the problem, which is not going very well for our world at the minute. Capitalism. If you go up to people on the street and say, what's your worldview? Nobody says I'm a capitalist, because nobody says, what's your worldview, to somebody on the street these days. But people will say, particularly if they're trained as lawyers and friends of mine, well, I'm just trying to become partner, and I want a bigger car, and I want a better house than the guy next door, and I just want to do better than everybody else in my firm, which is what drives most of my friends, it seems. Individualism, consumerism, materialism. I buy stuff. Like, why are we going to university if it's not to get a better job and to earn more money? Why do we want our kids to go to university? Not that many of you have kids yet, but that's why your parents worked really hard to send you to university to then present the thing that you learned at university. Well, that was maybe just me and my parents. So a lot of what we do is about me as an individual consuming stuff. We want to earn money to buy more stuff. Agnosticism and apathy, I don't know and I don't care. A lot of people have looked to the future and what's the world got for them. I don't want to think about that, that just makes my head hurt. And there's a few people who are atheists who have a belief statement that there is no God. And as I say, there's literally hundreds of isms around that. There's all sorts of doubters. Not the skeptical doubt that we used to have, which is to say, did Jesus really exist? Is there a God? And those kind of questions. And there was a question about it. The doubt today is, does anybody have any answers? Are there answers? You know, just a kind of skepticism of anybody in power and anybody in authority and anybody who claims to have answers. It's a really depressing kind of doubt today. I mean, huge questions about identity. We know that, you know. I mean, David Monte and I were just chatting there about both LGBTQIA .. issues and the gender debate. And again, those are questions primarily of identity. Very few people in the LGBT community that I'm engaging with are saying this is a relational issue. It's an identity issue. It's a framing of identity. And the transgender discussions that are going on are largely around identity. Sexual orientation, the thing that we might say we had an element of choice or subjectivity to it, who are you attracted to sexually, has now become locked and fixed according to the community. And gender, the thing that most people would have said is locked and fixed, has now become fluid. You can change R by R. I mean, that's the spaces in America are saying, no, it's gender fluid, as in I can wake up in the morning and say I'm a girl and I can by the afternoon be a boy. There's going to be some crack when people come to claim pensions and different things. There's going to be all sorts of interesting, because you get to claim pensions earlier if you're female. So suddenly at 60, lots of people are going to start claiming to be female. The ramifications are massive on some of this, but they're all identity questions. Who am I? Who am I? What is the story that shapes us? Why am I there? Because we're looking at this story. So there's lots of isms and stories on this. Actually, the dominant story is really incoherent. Not clear where we came from, not clear where we're going to. And yet our universities are framed on these kind of stories, which are actually split in the middle, because half of our universities are highly scientific, highly rational, and believe you've got to still hold to the empiricism of the Enlightenment. You've got to be able to test it, weigh it, feel it, touch it, know that it's there. And the other half, arts, history, psychology, economics, much more contested space, but literature, are all saying, no, we're postmodern. There's no such thing as truth. Everything's truth. You have your truth, I have my truth, and that's fine. And those are completely at odds with each other as two ways of viewing the world. That's completely inconsistent and incoherent. Our universities, university, are supposed to be based on one story, as opposed to the polytechnics, which are teaching us many techniques. The university has no longer got one story. It is disintegrating at its core, because it's tearing itself apart around some of these issues. The scientists do not understand the gender debate going on, and all those on the postmodern liberal arts side think this is perfectly normal. Of course, everybody has their own truth and everybody has their own story, and we just respect it. And the conflict is coming, and you begin to see it. So where does the God story fit in on this story of the world? The God story smashes across it. It's not running at an angle, it's not running at a slight tangent. It starts in a radically different place with the Creator. And Genesis is just answering and addressing. Answering sounds too pejorative for some people, so let's say addressing. It speaks straight away into some of the key questions of our age. Identity. It's at the bottom, hard to see here. Identity, who are we? That every single person is a divine image bearer. That every single person is made in the image of God. Everyone, that really annoying person in your work, class, context, whatever, boss, parent, brother, sibling, they are a divine image bearer. That any act of abuse against another human being is an act of high treason against God. Everybody bears the image of God. That we are made for relationship. We're made for relationship with God. It tells us right away in Genesis we're made for relationship with each other as human beings. And Genesis 2:15 makes it clear that a man should leave his mother and his father and go to be with his wife. It sets the framework and the paradigm for all relationships that follow. Family, extended family, etc., etc., into community and into nation. And that we are placed on this earth and we have a relationship with the very earth that we live and sustain ourselves from. We're made for relationship. And that we have a purpose. That every single human being is designed for a purpose to create and to cultivate. It's what we do. So, some people say that's really abstract and doesn't make a lot of sense, and my dad tells me this doesn't connect with people. And then I say, okay, so let's talk about an issue like human trafficking. So when we talk with others around human trafficking, and the recent legislation has come through, a thing called Lord Morrow's Bill, and that it's outlawed human trafficking in Northern Ireland, put us on the front foot of that agenda. It's outlawed paying for sex of any type. And so that makes Northern Ireland one of the most progressive or aggressive countries on this topic. So I would talk with other NGO groups and non-governmental groups who are engaged in that, and I'd say, why do you think human trafficking is wrong? Well, obviously it's wrong. I said, no, I know. But you don't let me say things are obviously wrong in any other debate, so let's just, you know, get the next line behind it. Why is human trafficking wrong? I said, they're a bit strong. You can't traffic people. And I said, oh no, I agree. Why is it wrong? You see, your story is that we are a random collection of cells. Your story is that we have evolved from and we are no different than the animals. Your story is we're not designed for any particular kind of relationship. And we are heading, most people in your story think, to capitalism. We can buy and sell anything. You can buy and sell people's labour. We have no problem with that. And you can buy and sell sex prior to this bill. And that was just accepted and is in most places in the world. So surely the next logical step is that you can buy and sell a person for sex. Why not? Why is it fundamentally wrong to traffic somebody? Why did you suddenly draw a line there and say that was wrong? They don't have an answer. The story isn't very coherent. So I was doing Nolan one day on child euthanasia. Belgium was proposing you could allow euthanasia for a 7-year-old with a terminal diagnosis. A 7-year-old can make the decision to end their own life. So I was opposed to that. And I said to the guys, out of interest, why me? It's not our specialist area. I said, surely loads of people were happy to speak against this. They said, no, nobody else would come on and do it. I said, what? They said, they'd already conceded the ground on abortion or euthanasia in general. And just because it was a 7-year-old, everybody thinks it's wrong. But they knew they conceded the argument at the beginning or the end of life. And they didn't want to get called out live on air by somebody like me. I said, hold on, just because they're 7, you don't want to do it? But you're allowing it at one or other of the ends of the spectrum. You see, there's a coherence and a logic to the story that we take into the public square. And other people don't have it. And we feel like we're on the defensive all the time because we don't ask good questions back and say, why do you think that? Why do you think this is a problem? You might not like the story that I inhabit, but at least it's coherent and it's consistent. Every act of abuse against another human being is an act of high treason against God. So human trafficking has 3 fundamental problems to me. Doesn't respect the person's identity as a divine image bearer. Doesn't respect the fact that they were made for a particular type of relationship, male, female, exclusive. And it doesn't respect the fact that God made everybody for a purpose to cultivate and to create, to steward the creation that he gave us, to work, to avodah him, to worship him in the work that we do. So it's got a problem for me. And so I'm going to stand against it. These guys have no story as to why it's wrong. They've just picked the issue of the day. And so we need to become bolder in the way we tell our story and engage on some of these issues. Tom Wright says this in a quote that is definitely not going to appear, so let's not worry. Hold on. So what? The way we frame this, and our story is not only starting at a different place in creation in Genesis, but it's heading to Revelation 21, where God will make his dwelling place with humanity. It's not escapism from Christianity. I'm a Christian, get me out of here. You know, I became a Christian at the age of 8, I've been twiddling my thumbs ever since, just waiting to go to heaven when I die. That is not the Christianity that you guys are talking about today, and I'm glad to hear it. It's about God coming out of heaven and into humanity. And we are the first fruits of that. We are the bearers of the kingdom, the king within us, Jesus. And so we take that out into the public square and transform it. We are the beginning of that movement of his coming back again. And so that's the job we do, because we find ourselves at the heart of the public square because that's where Jesus was. Jesus so upset the rulers of his day, both political and religious, that they had him crucified. He was right at the heart and upsetting their story. And he called it out and he jarred with it. Not just intellectually and academically, but just the way he lived. He really pissed them off. Otherwise you don't crucify somebody. He so upset them with the miracles that he did, the people that he ate with and dined with, the people that he engaged with. The way he lived his life was so upsetting to the public square that they had him crucified and put on a cross. And so we think this is exactly where we should find ourselves. And the public square to me is, check out counter at Tesco's. It is going through airport security, which I have to do from time to time. And in that moment, I have to confess, I'm very resentful at 6 a.m. when I'm pulled out of the screen line. But there's a moment where you stand like this. And isn't it funny, it's a kind of cruciform pose that you have to make. And I've got 2 choices. I can go, I really resent you. I don't like what you're doing. As you attempt to molest me, in my opinion, sometimes. Or I go, bless you, you're keeping us safe. I get you the job to do. Have a great day, thank you. And you know how important it is when we go into a restaurant or a coffee shop and somebody's just really grumpy or somebody's really friendly and how it just changes our day? Well, in that moment, I have that option as to how I'm going to engage in the public square in the simplest way. Every time I'm on Twitter, every time anybody's like, so yes, I do some media stuff. That is not the sole public square. We are all in versions of the public square. In our sports club, in our community groups, in our street, we live in the public square. And we have a choice as to what story we want to tell. And I think we need to do a better job of telling the God story. You see, what happened was, the about in 1880 or so, we began to shrink the gospel from creation, fall, he's going to forget what it is now, redemption and recreation, but there's a better word for that. But let's run with that. Creation, fall, redemption, somebody remember what it is? Restoration, thank you so much. Creation, fall, redemption, restoration. And we thought, well, that's too complicated for people because they're not that smart. So let's just shrink it down and say fall, redemption. So in about 1880, we began to cut out talking too much about creation and too much about restoration. And so it's a few lawyers like Finney and others got this really simplified gospel message that we have now become familiar with over the last 100 years. Well, you go and preach, you're really, really bad, you're fallen, and we have the answer, redemption. And we shrunk the gospel down, but when we did that, we lost our cultural influence. Historians look back and say, that's when Christianity began to lose its wider cultural influence, because it shrunk the story, and it didn't just cut out Genesis 1 and 2. We cut out all of creation narrative, which just has a thread the whole way through the text. And we didn't just rip out Revelation 21. We ripped out all the restoration narrative that's through that text. That is all that we're about. Creation and restoration are absolutely critical. So when you shrink the gospel and take those bits out and you just say fall and redemption, hey, you're really bad, I've got the answer. The lawyer thinks that's a great idea, and so lots of lawyers and evangelists began to just preach that way. That's a problem, because the gospel you get converted to is the one that shapes your life. If you get a shrunken, cheap version of the gospel, you get a rubbish faith out of that. So we need to teach a better gospel, and guess what we're doing now? We just shrunk it again, because the fall bit is a bit awkward. You're a sinner. You're a sinner. You're sorry, I'm going to pick on you, so I'm going to pick on Rick as well now. So you're definitely a sinner. So you're a sinner. Oh, it's a bit negative in the current culture. So Jesus loves you. That's all we're going to say. We don't even bother with the fall bit. Let's just have the redemption. Whoopee! Lovely, shiny story. It's rubbish. It's rubbish because it's not what the Bible tells us. And it's rubbish because there's no cultural carry. When you rip out creation, you lose out all this stuff around identity, relationships, creation care, human sexuality, all of that stuff goes out the door. You lose the whole restoration of what is to come. So when I was a kid, my dad used to throw things like this out the window of his car. I said, why? He said, because God doesn't care. He's going to burn up this earth. He's going to be interested in saving souls. And we had a really interesting conversation around that. And he stopped. And he's nearly understood why. Yeah, some of you know my father. I better be careful. But no, because we shrunk the story, and he said, no, it's only about saving souls. But no, that is not what the biblical text tells us. We have a much larger view of the public square and the world. He is in the business of redeeming all things. So, having taken advantage of the fact that I thought I was ahead of time, I'm now way behind. And so we talk about the pillars of the public square. I'll not say much about these now, but the question. So there's language out there that can be really helpful. Truth, justice, equality, freedom. Language that people in the public square are familiar with, that's used out there in our culture at large, but we also have a really strong biblical understanding of some of those things. Justice. I love justice. I'm wired for justice. That's what flows my blood. That's what drives me. But there's lots of different understandings of justice. The Bible talks about mishpat. That's a punishment type of justice. And most people in our culture, when they say they want justice, they want that punishment. But it also talks about tzedekah, which is the establishment of right relationships, which is a different form of justice. And the more tzedekah you have, the more right relationships, the less need there is for punishment. But our culture tends to focus on the punishing what went wrong rather than the building of the right relationships to stop it going wrong in the first place. We are justice in both sense. The mishpat is largely for God to do. The tzedekah, the right relationships, that's what we do. We build right relationships in our culture. And so we want to talk about justice and get in on issues, yes, like trafficking and pornography, like a weapon of mass destruction that's available not only now in every street corner, but just at the click of a button. If we think that isn't just a key thing that's wrecking our churches, then we need to wake up and smell the coffee, particularly for guys. But sexism, I mean, it's just inherent. The wife, I hate that phrase. You know, just, it's so inherent in our churches, and we need to be really careful. I have two daughters, and one of them is called Karen Hopper, my eldest daughter. Job had three daughters the second time round, Karen, Kezia, and Jemima. I've got the cat called Jemima. We're working on Kezia. We're not. So not true. But we've got Karen. Why is my daughter called Karen? Because my wife's an Old Testament scholar. And because we loved that Job's daughters got an inheritance in the Old Testament. That was highly unusual. It's really important to us. So tangenting again, but that's... But, like, culturally, we've got to shift so much around sexism and around sexuality within the church as well. That's related to justice because it's the establishment of the right relationships, how we treat one another. Equality, it is in danger of becoming the idol in our age. It is a problem. The Bible already declares equality. We are all equal. It's not something we're striving for. We absolutely believe it to be true. But I want to apply that to an issue like abortion, in which it was never raised. It's always about freedom, never about equality. Well, so where are the equal rights in this moment? Family and marriage contributes to equality, but nobody wants to talk about it. The biggest driver of equality is family and marriage. Marriage is the best way to establish equality for the children and for the female, realistically, in our society, in that relationship. When marriage breaks down, the people who suffer most are females and children. But our society won't talk about that as it re-narrates what marriage is. Marriage has been the best driver of equality. I talk statistically all day about that afterwards. So inequality, because of marriage, it just rises massively following any kind of relationship breakdown. It costs £43 billion a year in our society. It's 1,500 quid per taxpayer marriage, a relationship breakdown. It's massive. And we won't talk about it because it's no longer socially acceptable. We want to be on the front foot of that kind of stuff and all over it. Creation care is another equality issue. It is not possible for everybody to eat meat every single day. And I hated the guy who told me that. A Brazilian friend of mine said, "Oh man, you're still ruining my life. I cannot pray, give us this day our daily bread with integrity and live in a way that not everybody else can live. That causes me a problem, and I love meat, as I've hinted earlier, but I have to be moderate as to how I do that, because it's not possible for everybody. There's simply not enough land mass for all the cows. You need three worlds for all the cows to eat the way I want to eat meat, for everybody to do it." So it's great, those of you who are blessed with the gift of vegetarianism, who are offsetting me. But no, it's a real challenge to how we live, if we take equality seriously. Freedom. Everybody wants freedom. But euthanasia is not a freedom issue. Where is the freedom when you say to some old person, usually a grandparent, you're using up my inheritance by implication to keep you alive now. Like, there is not freedom in the decision-making that's going on here. There is no freedom for the unborn baby. There is no freedom in gambling. Fixed odds betting terminals pay back 97% of what you put in. But you can put in thousands of pounds in nets. They're designed to pay back 97%. You think you're winning. You put 100 quid in and straight away you get 97 quid back. And you're going, "Whoa, I've won a lot of money." You haven't. You've just lost 3 quid. But you lose 3 quid a second. Guy on the Nolan shows, talking with one day, and he said 300 quid he'd come out with from work that week. In the chip shop, by the time between ordering his chips and getting his fish and chips, he'd done his 300 quid. All gone. He kept winning at 97%, but it was going in so quickly. That's not freedom. Where are these machines? They are always in the most socially deprived areas. They are. Debt is not freedom. Consumerism is not freedom. We are not living in a free society and a free culture. Debt is the biggest bind in our society. We as Christians get on the front foot of that and understand it, become leaders in telling people how to manage money. I love what CAP does. I love the money management course. I love the youth stuff within that. Because so many people just don't understand. One of our interns said to me, "I've got this store card and I got some money off it, now I owe them 40 quid. I'm just going to ignore it." I said, "No, you're not." He said, "I'm going to take you aside and help you out because I'm going to get you 40 quid to save you a heck of a lot of pain." She had no comprehension of what was about to happen if she ignored that, watched the debt rise, and then would have had all sorts of problems getting any kind of loan in the future. And because we have an understanding, sometimes we can free people in different ways. And truth in a postmodern world. Well, if your friends are postmodernists, then they have to listen to your story. I mean, that's the beauty. I've got a story and I'm going to tell you that story. And if they are modernists and we want to do it the rational reasoning way, there's all sorts of ways we can engage in that. But we need to talk about the truth around adoption and the church are leading into that. We need to talk about the truth when it comes to an issue like Asher's and how important freedom is. There are some truthful conversations to be had around gender and sexuality. 1.3% of the population is gay. When you engage in the LGBT community, that's a stat that always causes angst in the room. Because I engage a reasonable amount. But that's the biggest sub-census survey, 450,000 people. It's accurate. Nobody really genuinely contests it, but they've established a narrative that it's about 7 to 10%. It is within a younger population, probably, but it's not in the population at large. We need to have honest conversations where truth comes into play. So, how do we live? How do we engage the public square? Oh, I just love the difference between equality and justice. So it's maybe hard to see. So equality, you give everybody the box. Little guy still can't see. Justice means you give him two boxes. One box, no box. Justice lets everybody see the game. I know it's American because it's baseball. But it's still right. equality is not the same as justice, and justice is a more interesting idea. So I was debating with John from the Rainbow Coalition one day, and he said, well, that's just not equality. And I said, that's okay, I don't believe in equality. And he freaked out. He didn't quite know what to do, because nobody doesn't believe in equality. And I do. But I wanted to put some caveats. So I said, what do you mean by equality? Equality is really hard to define on the radio in about 15 seconds. I said, I'm much more interested in justice. It's a much more interesting idea, because there are some people who are going to need more help. And that's not equality. It's not equality. It's different, but it's necessary. We have to give the little guy too sometimes. It's a much richer idea. It's a much more interesting idea. Equality is a subset of justice, and these are both subsets of human dignity. We as Christians have a better framework to understand this, I think. We don't need to be scared to go into that. So how do we engage? Well, too often we've condemned, critiqued, copied, and consumed. These are our favourite ways of engaging in culture. It's bad. So we just condemn it. And then we get a little bit more sort of culturally savvy, and we critique it. We say, well, you know, I just didn't really like the way they did that in that film. And we just sit in the sidelines, and we're constantly just critiquing. And we're really good, particularly I think in Northern Ireland, sitting on the sidelines saying, yeah, it was an okay conference, okay service, could have been better, could have changed that, could have done this. Instead of going off our backsides and doing something about it. then we copy. Wife is the devil of all the good music, so we copy it and make just Christian hip-hop that is just tragically bad. Or whatever, you know. So it's generally not as good as the real thing. Probably worst of all, and mostly, we just consume it. So we go to the movies, because I'm an American, we go to the cinema, and watch the same film as the person beside us, and we walk out in the same way that they do. And it has made not, you know, we have the same reactions that they do. We just consume. And it doesn't make any difference to us. We just watch these shows, we sit on the web. I mean, look at the language we use for surfing the web and vegging out in front of TVs. It's as if we've disengaged our brains and we just let stuff come in and we just consume it. And these are fine as gestures. Andy Crouch, really great on this stuff, says, great, there's time you have to gesture and say, no, that is rubbish. And let's critique that and pull it apart. And let's copy that. It's a good thing, and let's eat that up, because it's just lovely. Yeah, consuming it. But if those become your permanent posture, we're in trouble. It can't be the permanent way that we engage in these things. So, moving towards a close. How do we engage? There's some stuff we do have to confront. I think that's slightly different than condemning and critiquing. We need to call out the lies of our culture. I mean, that's the Old Testament prophetic way. It's actually, it's not just saying it's bad. It's actually, it's based on lies. Let's get behind it and say, that's just some rubbish out there. And we need to confront that stuff. That may or may not be controversial. I mean, I think on areas like abortion, we do need to confront some of the lies that are out there. And so there's a few of the folks in our office are really working on that, trying to build a number of female voices around this, trying to build understanding of what real choice looks like, what are the care pathways that should be in place and are in place for those who are finding themselves with a very difficult pregnancy. And let's have some honest conversations. Is this or is this not a human being? Is it alive and is it human? It's clearly human, and then is it a being or not? And you can see where the shift is going. Fetal abnormalities to say, well, it's not really a human being. It's not really alive, so we'll get rid of those because that wasn't a human being. Then sexual crime after rape. Most difficult cases, actually incredibly rare, and hardly any rape victims do want to abort their babies. But then it becomes that the argument is, so, well, okay, it is a human being, but a very difficult case. But once you concede that, it's a human being, there is then no logical reason not to go wholesale abortion. It just isn't. It's fundamentally a human being or it's not. That is the only philosophical, legal, theological question that is in play. It either has all the rights of a human being or none of the rights. Our Attorney General has been pretty blunt about that. He said, what is the difference between terminating it the day before it is born and taking a gun to his head the day after? And we need to get behind the arguments, because people like Peter Singer, who is the world-leading ethicist in this area at Harvard, is saying it is not a human being until it's about 9 months old, until it's some sense of personality. I don't know if you've held a one-week-old, a six-month-old, a nine-month-old. I mean, there's a part of which you say, oh, I get what you're saying. That's when it really begins to recognize and engage. But that's just what Peter Singer is saying. World's leading ethicist in this area. You can terminate that baby until it's 9 months old. Post-birth abortion, you would call it. I just call it murder. I think it's a simpler way of doing it. It's a truth conversation. Because that's like the moment when you come out either way of coming, is irrelevant. It's 25% pop out the sunroof, and they're always, why am I saying? He rightly, in my view, argues that the moment of birth is irrelevant to personality and humanhood. He's going one direction, saying it doesn't arrive until you've got personality and personhood at about 9 months, roughly. Incredibly arbitrary how you're going to work that out. Only a philosopher in Harvard could think that you could actually legislate around that. I'm going the other way and saying, you're right, birth is not the point at which something appears. I want to go right back and say all the DNA are there in the zygote, all the personality traits are there, everything is there. If you've seen the scans that they can now do it, the 4D scans at such an early stage, if you've seen an aborted baby or a baby born, either born earlier or that didn't survive, you still see everything is there. Anyway, why am I on that? Because we need to confront on some issues and say, there's a problem and call out the story behind it. What is the real story here? Whether you agree or disagree with that particular issue, I think there are ones that we're going to need to confront and the stuff you'll need to confront. Secondly, cultivate. There's some stuff that is just really good. There's some really good stuff in our culture that we want to get behind. And that for you could look really different. It could be sports, it could be food, it could be all sorts of stuff. It could be family, it could be just the work that you do. And we cultivate that. Because you don't just sit down and write a new song or a new tune. You're a musician who has practiced hard and learned your instrument well, and then you create something new. A surgeon does not just come up with a new technique, but 1,000 times performs a routine operation and then comes up with something new. They have cultivated their skills. And so we cultivate what is already good, and we weed out the little things that are bad. So my kids, my oldest one in particular, learning to read. And we cultivate that, and we give her books, and then we weed out when she says the word we or like in every sentence, because we're in a country school up on the coast. And so now I'm not allowed to say we or like in any sentence either, so I have to ban that in my office in Belfast. And then I said, oh, I really like that. Karen says, no, Daddy, you can't say like. I said, no, I can in that sentence. I'm just not allowed to put it on the end of every sentence. But we had to ban the entire use of the word like. But we're cultivating what is good. It's great that you read and you write and you draw, and we're helping you to do that. And then we're weeding out some of the small things, the wee things. Would you like a wee bill for your wee cup of coffee? There you go, there's your wee receipt. The interesting little habits. So we cultivate marriage, and we cultivate parenting, and we cultivate music and sport and health and freedom. We cultivate and we work with someone like Peter Thatchell, who comes out and says, actually, I support ASHRAE, the UK's leading gay rights campaigner, saying actually freedom is really important here. I had debated Peter a couple of times on radio and TV, and one of my team rang and said, hey, Peter Thatchell's just come out in favour of ASHRAE's. Not just come out, because that was 20 years ago. He's just come out in favour of ASHRAE's. Hey, and guess what? He's used entirely the lines that we were using against him only a few months ago. But we cultivate that and say, that's a good thing. We've been engaging with the committee and saying, actually, this is not a great case. In terms of the LGBT community, it's about freedom. It's not about sexual orientation. They did not know it was sexual orientation. That is clear as day. I sat in court the whole way through. Nobody seriously contests that. The only person who thinks that is Isabel Brownlee, the judge. But nobody else does. Even the community don't acknowledge that. He bought his products in there lots of times before. If they fail to serve somebody based on their sexual orientation, I'd be out there with the LGBT community saying that's fundamentally wrong. They didn't. They'd served them many times, but they would not do that cake. And so we need to cultivate what's good in there, the arguments for freedom. We need to cultivate CAP and support for businesses and creative ideas. We want to get behind marriage and parenting and say 70% of marriages still happen in churches. That's way more than the people who go to church. Great. That's the moment we speak in and we cultivate what is good in that. Because where do people go when their marriages are in trouble? The one place that people spoke into them on their way into their marriage. Like, that's a great thing to do. So we want to cultivate what's good in marriages. People say to me, will you come and speak against same-sex marriage? And I say, well, do you run a marriage course? And they say, no. And I say, well, then I'm not coming to talk to you. Like, if you're not promoting what is good and cultivating what is healthy in our society, then let's not bother about the 1% same-sex marriage bit. Let's cultivate the good stuff. That's where we're going to have the biggest cultural impact, when we speak well into marriages and talk well about them. And finally, we create. We put new stuff out there. A new product, a new child, a new family unit, a new system, a new piece of art, a new idea. Like a new small group. We create stuff all the time, a new friendship. And we do all sorts of stuff. And again, Andy Crouch, who does this, says he loves chili. And his kids hate chili. And so he has chili night every Thursday and he makes the chili. And he said, you know what, they can condemn it. They can critique it. They can consume it, which is what he'd like them to do. He said, the only way that's going to change is if one night I come home
and they've already made a beautiful Thai green curry and put something in its place. That's how we change culture. We don't just sit in the side and say, well, that bit's rubbish, or like that. We put something new out there. We set up our own group. We set up our own thing. We drive something new forward. We don't say that coffee shop's rubbish, that restaurant's no good. Okay, so let's set up a new one that is good and that we like, and a new group, and thrive in that. So we do that by creating, because Hannah's moving forward. How am I going to stop him? So in a consumer, so we put these 100 Days magazines out, and some of you may have heard of them. I've got some here, because I can never resist the sale. But we said, how are we going to respond to the 100 Days of History? How are we going to respond to the Easter Rising and the song? And so with Alan Emerson and John Key and some others, we said, okay, why don't we pray into that space? That seems a wise thing to do in that moment. So we created the prayer app and got that going, and Alan worked with others in prayer rooms. And then we said, we need to tell something of the story. We don't understand our history well. And then let's invite some others into that. And so we created the magazine, and we had no idea what we were doing really, but God was good and gracious in that. But in doing that, because of John Larkin, the Attorney General's comments, we got some media coverage, and it's kind of created a table, a metaphorical table, that people are sitting around and having conversation. It's sparked the conversation on, the media picked up on it. And so in our small way, we're creating something a little bit different, moving the conversation along. What does it look like to be reconciled? Can reconciliation happen without reunification? Yes, McGuinness states categorically. That was unknown. There was a strong belief that actually that wasn't Sinn Féin's view. So that was really helpful. The Easter Rising is profoundly wrong, John Larkin says. But he said then also, that the media are less inclined to pick up, is that reconciliation is a theological idea that can only be understood through a lens of forgiveness. It's a fundamentally Christian notion. How can you be reconciled if there is not grace and forgiveness? Well, that's really interesting for the leading legal figure in Northern Ireland to state that on the record. So it gets the conversation going. We have a victim and somebody whose brother was a young policeman and was shot in her journey of healing, to be able to stand at the front of our church one Easter and say, brother killed, killer's forgiven, to switch that card over on Easter Sunday morning. Former UDA commander, to talk about what it was like to be in those conversations in the maze, and what it was as a non-Christian at that point, and saying, we're either going to have peace or war, but here's the thing, if we're going back to war, we're going to do it properly. It's a conversation that he and Stoner, Michael Stone and Johnny Adairmal had. It's going to be like Bosnia, and there's going to be bodies in the streets, and we're going to kill thousands. We're not doing tit for tat. It's either all out war or all out peace, and everybody voted for peace, or 98 of them voted for peace. And to hear those conversations and what was going on, and God was at play even in the maze, and what some of the stuff that they were doing. Become a creative minority is not easy, because it involves maintaining a strong link with the world while staying true to your faith, seeking not merely to keep a sacred flame burning. We all know people are trying to do that. Let's just keep it burning. Let's just keep this little thing alive. But also to transform the larger society of which we are part. That's a demanding and a risk-laden choice. The former chief rabbi, Jonathan Sacks, talking to Christians about the experience as a Jewish leader of how they do this. What they've learned essentially from Daniel and the exile. It's more than keeping the flame alive. That's not going to work. We want to transform wider society. Questions for you as I close. What do you need to confront? Personally, local level, in your church, in your circle of friends, in your group? I bet you a lot of you know people are using porn. A lot of people know stuff, sexist stuff that's going on. I bet you know some stuff that's just rubbish in your culture. People are watching. I might have a thing about Game of Thrones, but whatever, stuff like that that you know is just unhealthy. Open it up to the occult. People are leaning into spaces that are just unhealthy and reading some trashy, rubbishy stuff. Maybe we need to sit down and say, why are we doing that? What do we need to cultivate? What's really good and healthy? What's the running groups, the sports groups, the culture? You say, actually, that'd be really good to get in the local club and get with the hockey club and just cultivate some good stuff that's already going on there. And what do we need to create anew? Where are the gaps? Where do you want to step in? Sitting there for you guys, you can do it. It's awesome. There's big spaces out there. You just try something, you throw it out. It's never been a better time to kick off something new and to change culture in that way. That's how we do it. You don't condemn the chili night. You come up with a Thai green curry recipe that kicks your dad's ass and boom. Then that displaces his night. We've got to create some new stuff and put it out there to change the culture here. There's no point sitting on the sidelines complaining about the politicians and stuff that we have. Just go ahead and create some new stuff that makes a difference. Do it. It's just in the ones and twos and the lives and spaces you're in. Alright, so I'm definitely not doing questions. Can I pray? Will I just finish up by praying? Awesome. You can talk to me afterwards. Really happy to do that. As I've killed the time. Alright. Father, we are so thankful that you have invited us into your story. That you have invited us into the God story. And we just reflect upon that. The incredible privilege. Thank you. Thank you. We are blessed. And Father, I just pray for the folks here that you will be shaping identity and stories in people right now, giving them new God stories. I pray for fresh encounters with you, Father. I pray for fresh encounters. This afternoon, as they're doing stuff, as they're out in the trams, wherever they are, as they're just meeting with people, there will be fresh God moments. I pray for boldness. I pray over the next few days for fresh dreams and visions and encounters with you, that everyone in this room will have a God story to share. Yes, I pray for a releasing of power and authority, that we will not be afraid to have the bold conversations, that we will not be afraid to pray and to speak into lives, that we will be asking for words of wisdom and insights into our friends, that we will be engaging with them and saying stuff that they will have no idea where it came from, not to show off, not to do anything other than to lead them to Jesus. We pray that friends and colleagues and family and others will encounter Jesus because of a boldness released in this room, the power and authority that is here, Father, from you. And so I pray that you release us. Release us into that we will know what to confront, we will know what to stand up to, and we will know what to cultivate, and that we will know afresh what to create. Give us access to divine solutions. Give us access to the heavenly realms, Father. Give us plans and downloads. I pray tonight that people will get new ideas, that they will just get fresh inspiration. They will wake up and start texting, typing them into the phone, because they will have an idea from you, a thought, a sermon, a poem, a picture, a painting, a business, Father, an idea for a relationship to change things, to engage differently in a community. Just give fresh ideas. Pour them out, Lord. Pour them out, for you are the source of all good things. And may we change culture, not the whole of Northern Ireland initially, Father, but the small culture around us. And as we do that, that will have ripple effects that will continue and continue beyond what we can ask or imagine. May we change the culture around us. Come, Holy Spirit. Come, Lord Jesus. Fill us with your power. Fill us with the power of the resurrection. In the name of Jesus, whose name we bear. Amen. Thank you.